Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Christine Kutsia, Anna-Marie Siliers, Herman Klein, and Sarah Jones for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a special episode. These special episodes are a newish feature to the podcast in which I focus on specific elements of true crime that could do with a deeper dive. Last year, I covered parts 1 and 2 on human trafficking, and this week I'm getting into the final part 3. With more information on the various and sometimes horrifying ways that human traffickers work. My sources for this episode include some online articles as well as information from the Savamus magazine and reports published internationally. So, let's get into your True Crime South Africa special episode for this week, Human Trafficking Part 3. Before I get into the information part of the special episode, I'd like to thank you all for your responses to the previous two parts of the special series. Many listeners let me know that they'd found value in the content and that they'd learned a lot along with me about this topic. I did have one listener reach out and provide some constructive feedback, which really made me think. It was pointed out to me that using research reports from America solely to form an opinion about which different situations in different countries might constitute trafficking is a little dangerous, because those reports are usually put together by government agencies from that country, who undoubtedly would lean their data toward their own government's agendas. This was in specific reference to the Cuban doctors in South Africa reference during COVID, which I mentioned in part 2. And the listener pointed out that the American government may well have an agenda in trying to paint Cuba as a country who may abuse their citizens. I honestly did not even think about that aspect of it when I put that part together, and the listener is quite correct. Going forward in these special episodes, where I'm using country-specific data, I will certainly try and keep the international relationships between countries in mind as far as possible, for fairness. With that said, if you haven't yet listened to part 1 and 2 of this special series, I have linked the first two parts in the show notes, or you can also just scroll through your True Crime South Africa feed on the app you use, right down to last year's episodes, and you'll find them there. Now, let's get going with part 3 of this special series, looking into human trafficking. In the first two parts, we learned how human trafficking is often conducted and all the forms in which it can take place. And we often hear about victims of human trafficking being rescued, but the individuals apprehended with them, if any, are really just the lower level guys, the ones who move the victims around. And while it's important to rescue any victims, for any meaningful arrests to happen, police need to get to the upper levels of the organizations. To do this, they conduct less physical and more digital investigations to follow the money back up to the people in charge. This is often where these types of crimes cross over with other organized crimes, like scams and fraud, because the methods used to hide the money are so similar and often involve the same money laundering groups. The money launderers are usually individuals who don't participate in any other way in the criminal groups they assist. Their sole purpose is to help criminal organizations move their money around and avoid detection. There are two types of money launderers: those who launder solely for one organization, and those who offer money laundering as a general service to various criminal entities, regardless of the type of crime they're involved in. Over the years, investigation into human trafficking has shifted into preventative measures rather than just reactive. By following the money and flagging transactions that appear suspicious, law enforcement agencies across the world are able to identify new human trafficking rings starting up and flag individuals who may be at risk of becoming either perpetrators or victims. The methods used to launder money and the ways this is investigated differ according to where in the world the traffickers are operating. In places like the United States, money laundering is much more digital, and on the African continent, because we still have a pretty big culture of cash, following the money becomes a little more difficult. In Africa, bribes to law enforcement and other officials are the main red flag financial behaviors which could indicate an involvement in human trafficking or other criminal activity. In an episode and interview I did earlier in the podcast regarding financial crimes in South Africa, I mentioned how ordinary citizens and businesses are vital to the fight against human trafficking and other organized crimes, because they often inadvertently become middlemen in the money laundering process. This is very common in the real estate industry, and there are two ways that this can happen where human trafficking is concerned. The first is that rented and owned properties are often used for the harboring phase of human trafficking. This is where victims are hidden in plain sight, often within busy communities, before they're moved on to either their end point in the trafficking plan or another harboring location. The other way that property could be used in trafficking is in the laundering of money. Properties are purchased, usually with a large portion of cash, and they'll either be later used for other criminal purposes or held onto for a few years and then sold. The proceeds then effectively come out the other end clean. The use of real estate for money laundering is less common than other methods because it's pretty slow, but real estate agents are still well placed to pick up suspicious behavior in prospective buyers. Money laundering for human trafficking rings is achieved in a few different ways. The first is through front companies. This is where a company does do some legitimate business, but really just enough to hide the criminal stuff that's happening in the background. Front companies that are often used for human trafficking include bars, restaurants, escort agencies, massage parlors, and strip clubs. The services offered usually are present. Food and alcohol is served. You can get a massage there. But in another, more hidden section of the premises, Customers who want illegal services can get those too, at a price, and usually from victims of trafficking. Another way is through exploitative employment processes. This happens when victims of trafficking are either paid far less than they were promised, with some set of fees being deducted from their wages, which wasn't agreed on beforehand, or withholding wages completely, and forcing victims to continue working by holding something over their heads like confiscated passports, or isolating them so much that they would have no way out without money. This happens to locals, but it also happens to both legal and illegal foreign workers. People who don't have access to systems to understand the process of applying for work visas can often be tricked into working in countries illegally because their traffickers will have claimed that they organized a work visa on their behalf. Alternative payment methods are another way of laundering illegal proceeds. These include prepaid cards, peer-to-peer payment platforms, or third-party payment apps. If you, like me, regularly complain about how platforms like PayPal are super strict on certain countries, including South Africa, this is one of the reasons why. We can thank human trafficking and other illegal schemes who try to use these platforms for money laundering. The next method of money laundering for human traffickers is funnel accounts. This is when someone uses their bank account set up in one location to receive money for several victims or traffickers. Then those victims or traffickers withdraw the money in another geographic location. In addition, victims can be used as funnel account holders by being forced to open bank accounts under their names through coercion or physical force. With it now being possible to open bank accounts online, this is now easier than ever to achieve. The industries in which funnel accounts are most prevalently weaponized include travel agencies, recruitment firms, au pair services, modeling agencies, matchmaking services, massage services, construction, agriculture, mining, food processing, and domestic services. Because the financial landscape in Africa and South Africa in particular is slightly different from North America and Europe, for instance, we have some specific avenues that are used to launder money from human trafficking. These include the alternative money moving service Hawala, which was created in India and is based on essentially a trust program without any moving of actual money. Hawala dealers take 10% of the money moved through the service. Mobile phone-based services are also used to move illicit funds in South Africa. Examples of these are M-Pesa, and even services owned by banks, such as FNB's e-wallet. As cryptocurrency becomes more widely used in South Africa, digital currencies are fast becoming a way to launder money from human trafficking and modern slavery as well. Casinos offer another popular method to launder money. Even though most casinos do work with authorities, it remains difficult to identify every single suspicious patron, especially if traffickers are using victims to launder money through gambling. As mentioned in part one of this series, other methods used to launder money include smurfing, electronic money, offshore investments, complex trust structures, money mules, online gambling, and gift cards. The COVID-19 pandemic had just as big an impact on the criminal world as it did on the honest, ordinary folk. In the period before 2018, banking was still done much more in branch and far less online. But after the pandemic, that shifted significantly, and it also changed the way human traffickers moved their money. Cash remains a very difficult method to track, unless large cash deposits are made into bank accounts on a regular basis. Cash laundering also only becomes evident when large cash purchases are made, such as houses and cars. Personally, I've also heard of individuals enrolling their children into expensive private schools and then arriving to pay for an entire year's worth of school fees in cash. Looking at someone's bank account and identifying the clues of human trafficking are not always absolute, because victims are usually held in a premises somewhere. You'll often still see normal expenses coming off their bank account, like cell phone data and the like. If victims have been trafficked overseas, some of the clues you could look for include transactions like forex exchanges and flight purchases. There's also been an increase in the laundering of money through crypto assets for the purposes of producing or purchasing pornography. It's important to note, of course, that it's not necessarily just a method of laundering, but it's also a further way to abuse trafficking victims. It has been clear for a very long time that even in pornography that features adults, not all of the participants are consenting to being there or appearing in the pornographic material. It's not uncommon for both women and men to be trafficked for the purposes of pornography production. In addition, pornography purchases may not be a red flag for investigators, but it is an excellent way to filter money from illicit services back into illicit services through a so-called legitimate platform. Certain crypto asset platforms in South Africa have started working with authorities to flag these suspicious transactions. Some of the unusual financial transaction behavior that could be red flags for human trafficking include businesses which are solely cash-based, a perpetrator being registered with a money remitter but never actually transacting through it themselves. Transactional activity in an account is limited to the moving of money around, inconsistent client credit turnover, no business-related transactions in the account, extensive use of cryptocurrency, a client transacting with various account holders at the same bank who are all employed with the government, account turnover increasing significantly with no good explanation from the previous year, the transaction patterns not matching the type of business the individual claims to run, the account holder saying that they're employed but no salary payments show on their account, withdrawals and deposits into the account are always round amounts, the individual sends large amounts of money to people in foreign countries with references such as gift, cash businesses that generate a huge amount of cash daily, grocery businesses that are sold at inflated prices, rapid movement of funds, and no proof of the source of those funds. Numerous advance payments for goods often imported from China, but always from different suppliers. Funds being sent to unknown individuals. And finally, possibly smurfing. Often just looking at the references used when payments are made can help to start flagging the movement of illicit money. If the references are almost always solely female names, Asian names when the depositor isn't legitimately connected in any way with Asian people or businesses, as well as nicknames such as Pastor, Divine, or Temple. Illicit deposits can also be referenced with room numbers or cell phone numbers and business names which fit into flagged industries such as Thai spas, ad agencies, adult entertainment venues, travel agencies, or textile manufacturers. References such as entertainment, 5 ads in Feb, hair, income, coins deposits, and perhaps for the less smart criminals, even dirty money, are often seen as red flags. Other lifestyle and financial red flags which can help to identify people involved in human trafficking include using cash through couriers, money remitters, or regular small amount withdrawals or transfers, the use of multiple bank accounts, credit cards and many aliases, identities and addresses, the use of fake companies, straw men, or fake IDs, when the person's lifestyle doesn't match the income they receive or the job they claim to have, being in contact with known criminals. As I mentioned previously, of course, buying high-ticket items like real estate with cash or majority cash. The lack of any legitimate business behind financials or bank accounts. Frequent money transfers to high-risk countries. The facilitation of third-party cash deposits at bank branches or at ATMs. And a pattern of card transactions, usually between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., among others. So it's clear that a lot of work has been done to identify the red flags and figure out ways to follow the money to find the victims and the perpetrators. But there are still challenges, even once these identifications are made. The first is something we see in many crimes that involve coercive control, and that is that victims of human trafficking don't always identify as victims. Many victims of human trafficking are often brought into a different country through illegal means, and it is this very fact that their traffickers will hold over their heads to control them. While it may be difficult for most people living in decent conditions to understand, the desperation that many victims of human trafficking have to get out of the situation they find themselves in their home country can drive people to accept even the most horrendous of conditions and still not consider themselves victims. I think it's one of those situations where if you don't understand, be grateful that you don't understand. And it's also often not just them that they have to think about, but also their family that they've left behind at home, and in terms of money that they hope to send back there, and also their family's safety, should they be threatened by the traffickers. In addition, imagine being dropped into a completely foreign environment with no resources. You may not speak the language, understand the culture, and you may well come from a country where the police and other authorities can't be trusted. There may even be people in authority involved in your trafficking. And then why would you think it would be helpful to reach out for assistance anyway? Even when victims are trafficked within their own countries, they're held in such isolation and given such a short proverbial leash that there's very little opportunity for them to try and get help. This type of isolation and sense of desperation to better their lives often makes victims see their traffickers as someone they need to keep happy, because they literally are their lifeline. Many of these victims expected life in a new country to be hard, and if there's no overt violence, they may easily convince themselves that the abuse they're suffering is just part of the journey. As much as law enforcement and experts in South Africa are learning huge amounts about human trafficking, how it works, and how to identify victims and perpetrators, one of the biggest challenges remains the lack of knowledge filtering down in a practical way to the feet on the ground. Several studies and reports found that police officers who are in daily contact with possible victims and perpetrators of human trafficking are very poorly educated in the red flags to look for and how to handle possible trafficking situations, especially when, as previously mentioned, the victims don't necessarily identify as victims. human trafficking perpetrators are very good at disguising themselves as other types of criminals when they're caught. They will shift the context of whatever crime they've been caught for to something that takes the attention away from the human trafficking ring. It's so vital, in their minds at least, to protect the ring, that they will gladly go to prison on other charges or even pretend to be illegal immigrants. This trend has started to come to light when certain offenders are arrested several times for less serious charges, and then eventually they're linked to a human trafficking group. And in retrospect, the signs were already clear at the time of the previous arrests that these individuals were likely involved in far more than just the crime they admitted to. Although this is likely a very far-off ideal, the most desirable situation would be to be able to address the situations that result in trafficking in the first place. Issues such as poverty, unemployment, inequality, porous borders, poor service delivery, and corruption all contribute to the sense of desperation that creates vulnerable victims for human trafficking. These issues will never be solved all at once, all across the world though, so it's vital to ensure that the education around trafficking continues, and as many sectors of society as possible are on the lookout for the red flags. Another really good suggestion I came across while researching is that data collected during trafficking investigations for the purposes of prosecution shouldn't simply be put away with the docket once the prosecution is attained. The trends, habits, and actions of prosecuted human traffickers are vital real-world research samples which can help to save future victims. At the moment, from the sources I looked at least, and in a local context, it's unclear whether that data is being used anywhere, and it's unlikely it is. Thankfully, there are currently conversations underway between NGOs and government departments to see if this data can be put to better use. The financial sector, of course, plays a major role in identifying human trafficking rings, but this also adds a huge amount of additional pressure to both the institutions and their honest clients. While doing the bare minimum might make processes faster and make clients happier all round, it also helps to let criminals get away with human trafficking and other organised crimes. So I guess, really, when we ask ourselves how we as average citizens can contribute to combating human trafficking, it's in ways that might seem small, but are undoubtedly helpful. Like understanding why you need to complete a few extra forms, or not being entirely annoyed at PayPal's pedantic nature towards South Africans. This is a note to self, really. And I guess just accepting that we all really can play a role, and sometimes that role is complying with the systems put in place to catch the bad guys. Human trafficking feels like an insurmountable issue, but there are projects in place and organisations working daily to try and prevent additional victims and save those who have already been trafficked. With these crimes almost always crossing borders, it's impossible for individual countries to fight human trafficking on their own, and international cooperation is vital. Law enforcement groups like Interpol, Afripol, and the SAPS do often work together on targeted operations, but it's impossible to do that constantly. So these groups rely heavily on raising public awareness through various outreach programs. These include through NPOs like A21, an organization established in 2008 whose aim is to end global slavery through a 3R system: reach, rescue, and restore. Through this, A21 hopes to target the three aspects that usually result in individuals being targeted and keeping them in trafficking: vulnerabilities, exploitation, and re-victimization. The organization has set up education guides around human trafficking targeted to children, teenagers, and adults. You can find these downloadable guides at www.a21.org. In addition to written guides, there are also comic book guides for children in countries where literacy levels are low. A21 offers a one-hour e-learning course called Human Trafficking, A Global Crisis. The course includes various snippets of information about human trafficking and also videos, some of which are specific to the South African context. A21 works together with the South African National Human Trafficking Hotline, which can be reached on 0800 222 777 to direct tips to authorities. Another organization which is more grassroots and involved at a practical level is Love Justice International. This UK-based organization opened a branch in South Africa in 2016 and aims to help catch human trafficking perpetrators by placing transit monitoring and interception stations in areas where trafficking is known to occur. Their teams are trained to spot potential victims, intercept and question traffickers, and get police involved at the correct levels. Love Justice also gathers and analyzes data to help stakeholders better understand how networks operate and the trends that appear and change over time. In much the same way that organizations like Rape Crisis help victims to approach authorities and navigate the legal framework should they want to, Love Justice plays the same role for trafficking victims. Like A21, Love Justice also has resources available through their website to help the public. One of their most important resources is an app called the Freedom App, which helps job seekers to identify whether a job opportunity is legitimate or whether it has the red flags of human trafficking. It also provides information on modern-day slavery, a questionnaire to help people figure out whether they might be at risk, as well as a panic button to mobilize private security and a chat function to engage with the Love Justice team. It's well worth your time to peruse Love Justice's resources and refer anyone you think might be at risk to them. Because most human trafficking for the purposes of modern slavery occurs in the labor sector, another organization called Stronger Together focuses specifically on this area. With human trafficking being so absolutely insidious and often not easy for the average person to spot, many companies may be supporting human traffickers by virtue of their supply chains, without even knowing it. Stronger Together's goal is to try and ensure that links are made between companies who regularly use the services of businesses known to be involved in human trafficking. The organization also offers presentations and courses to companies to help empower them with the knowledge they need to ensure they're not engaging with possible human trafficking syndicates. This is very common in the agriculture industry. So if you supply anything for human consumption to the public, which has its roots in any way in agriculture, these resources are vital for you. The same is true for construction. We saw this in the tragedy that occurred in May 2024 in George, in which 34 construction workers were killed when a building site collapsed. An inquest into that case still appears to be underway, but reports claim that many of the more than 80 workers on that site were either not South African, with their legal status in the country being undetermined, or they were working under extremely exploitative conditions, with individuals being asked to carry out tasks they were not trained for, and very low wages and long hours being a common thread. Of course, no clear ruling of human trafficking being involved in that case has emerged yet, but it certainly has many of the hallmarks. And it's not a situation most South Africans would peg as being a trafficking scenario that we're familiar with. In fact, a lot of xenophobia tends to rear its head when claims are made about possible illegal immigrants being involved. But as you've come to understand through the information in this series, the very nature of human trafficking means it's impossible to tell on the surface who is a victim and who is simply acting of their own accordance. Although this episode will conclude my deep dive into human trafficking for now, in the future I'll also be looking deeper into some of the specific aspects that have come up in my research. This includes how much human trafficking may or may not be involved in illegal mining, given what has recently happened in Stilfontein and the huge number of deaths there. If there's anything I've learned during this true crime journey of mine, it's that things aren't always how they look on the surface, and the world is not simply made up of good and bad. There are very many gradients in between, and so much to continue learning. I do hope that you found value in this deep dive special series, and please do keep your comments and emails coming with your views on what you've learned. I'll be back in a couple of days with a new full case episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.